time for This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlantis. Anna, good morning.
Good morning, Bob.
We heard a lot about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald last week, but we're remembering another shipwreck this morning, aren't we?
Yeah. This one dates back to 1912, Bob, long time ago, but this week marks the anniversary of one of the most treacherous and storied shipwrecks in the maritime history of the Great Lakes. The 123-foot-long Rouse Simmons, carrying thousands of Christmas trees, was on its way from Michigan's Upper Peninsula to Chicago when a fierce storm hit. And the ship that was loaded down with these evergreens were supposed to be delivered to Chicago area families. It was this big deal at the Clark Street docks every year, an annual tradition. So the ship's captain would pull in. Herman Schunemann was his name. He became known as Captain Santa. And everybody would flock to the docks and buy these Christmas trees. And then he'd also give some out to needy families. He dropped them off at local churches and community centers. And so he was loved, and it was this really cool tradition. That year, though, 1920, there was word received of a distressed ship out in the Great Lakes, and then Christmas trees started washing up on the shores of Lake Michigan a few days later. So the fate of the ship became obvious as days went by, and sadly the crew went down with the ship, and the remains of it are still on the floor of Lake Michigan to this day. They've had divers go down there near Two Rivers, Wisconsin, right off there, that coastline. And they basically have done documentaries on this ship. But for 83 years, there were no Christmas tree deliveries. That whole tradition ended. Fast forward to 1997, the Coast Guard, U.S. Coast Guard, restarted it. And this December 5th, Navy Pier, you can see the Christmas tree ship pull up to the docks, learn a little more about its history, tour it if you want. You can jump on board, and they play great music, and they have this little fun holiday party, and then they give out 1,200 Christmas trees to needy families.
Great story. Cool. Forgotten Chicago history. Let's remember what Devin Hester did this week in 2006.
Love this fun Bears memory, Bob. This is a good one. November 12th, 2006. Devin Hester proved why we just love Devin Hester so much and why he made it into the Hall of Fame. A flashback to the game against the New York Giants. It was Hester's rookie season, Bob, when this happened. He returned a missed field goal, running it all the way back 108 yards for a touchdown. And Devin Hester became an instant celebrity in this town. And who knew he'd score many, many, many more times in a similar fashion over the next few years, returning punts and kickoffs for just like touchdowns and incredible, memorable moments for Bears fans and setting NFL records in the process. We pulled the moment. Giants kicker lined up for a 52-yard field goal when he missed the uprights, and then it found its way into the hands of the ball. That found its way into the hands of Devin Hester. Unbelievable play 20 years ago.
Al Michaels with the call.
He became one of the most feared return guys in the NFL. Remember how we'd all sit there with bated breath, like, is this going to be another one? And remember, Bob, the opposing coaches would tell players, don't kick near Hester, just don't do that. Mm-hmm. Except, famously, in the Super Bowl, when Tony Dungy said that he wouldn't do that either, but just minutes before the big game, he was on national television and said, I hope we lose the toss, because if we do, we're going to kick it right to Hester, and when they know that we've taken out their biggest threat, then they're going to be finished. Of course, we know what happened. 13 seconds later, Hester returned the opening kickoff for a touchdown. That may have been the highlight of the game, but we'll hold on to that one. That was a big moment.
Imagine what Hester would do with these new kickoff rules. Wow.
Exactly.
We've got some other football history to talk about involving the great Red Grange. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this one, 100 years ago, I was watching the Northwestern game at Wrigley, and it was interesting because they did a little mini tribute to it. But 100 years ago, 1925, the Chicago Bears signed a player named Red Grange and basically changed the trajectory of not only the Bears, but the NFL and the game of professional football. It was that significant. George Papa Bear Halas signed Red Grange, University of Illinois star athlete, just standout athlete, century ago. Few days later, he made his professional debut with the Bears at Wrigley Field. 35,000 people turned out. It was standing room only for Grange's debut. And to put that into perspective, Bob, only about 5,000 fans were going to most football games at that time. 35,000 came out for that particular game. And Halas said, the minute Red Grange agreed to play for the Bears, I knew the NFL had a future. He He says it was the most important thing he ever did for the Chicago Bears, and that one act made professional football big league. It changed everything, he said in his autobiography. So pretty interesting to put that in perspective, because back then the NFL was a money loser. Teams were folding. Star athletes would go work in a manufacturing plant because they'd get paid more there than in professional sports. And the crowds, they just didn't show up. So Halas zeroed in on him, paid him $100,000 salary, which was unbelievable in 1925, and then gave him 50% of the door, which is another pretty cool perk, kind of unheard of. And Red Grange played his final game at the U of I. He showered up, shook hands with his teammates, and then walked into a waiting car with Halas and his contract. We have we pulled a little audio here from the background of the author behind Red Grange, his life and legacy, and explains why Grange, what he did for the game of football.
The Bears made a fortune, and so did the NFL, thanks to Red Grange.
It all turned at that point, Bob, and it became a highly profitable sport, and the NFL became legitimate in the eyes of American sports world, too. Pretty cool moment.
Oh, yeah. Rolling Stones and Muddy Waters. That was quite a historic night, wasn't it, Anna?
It was, Bob. You think about this week, 1981, this was the meeting of legends at the legendary Chicago venue, the Checkerboard Lounge in Bronzeville there on the city south side. Mick Jagger and the Stones showed up to play a special set with their musical idol, Chicago blues man Muddy Waters. Waters had been performing like a private guests-only performance. He had a gig there, and it was limited seating, like 150 people or so. But when word got out that on the radio that Mick Jagger had shown up to the club, that there was this might have been happening, over 1,000 Chicagoans made their way over there to try to get in. The Stones were in town, by the way, for a three-night concert series at the Rosemont Horizon, as it was known then, and they wanted to perform with Muddy Waters, who was a huge inspiration for them. They named their band after a Waters song. He was just a musical hero to them. And Muddy and his band began the evening on their own. The Stones just showed up in the audience and kind of were drinking and smoking. Keith Richard actually showed up on stage, still holding his fifth of whiskey, and then they just started jamming together, and it was magical. Whatever they were drinking, it just was such a magical moment in music. We pulled a clip of them on stage, the Stones making their childhood dreams come true that day, as they said later, at the Checkerboard Lounge.
Yeah, the Live at the Checkerboard Lounge album, and they're called the Rolling Stones because of Muddy, aren't they?
Because of the Rolling Stone, one of his songs. And apparently Keith Richards said in an interview at one point that I looked at the floor when we're trying to come up a name for the band, and we got a gig, and I saw his album on my floor, and I chose that name. But that was 1981 too, Bob. Kind of significant, because 1 year later Waters had to retire due to poor health, and 2 years later he was no longer with us. So that moment in time was just such an important moment for the Stones and really for music history.
Absolutely. And finally, I'm so glad you're delving into the history of the phosphate, because I'll tell you about a controversy that I've been involved in. But fill us in first, Anna.
Well, okay, I saw in Chicago Magazine that you claimed that you love the chocolate phosphate. And I was a chocolate phosphate girl, too, because my dad used to own a soda fountain. And so they're kind of a throwback thing. And a lot of people don't like them, Bob, so I don't know if that's your controversy. But this is interesting, because when the soda fountains started going all across the city, these became popular. You know, like the chocolate phosphate was like as popular as the malt, except unlike the malt, didn't have any ice cream or milk in it. It had the chocolate syrup, the phosphoric acid, and the carbonated water in it. But they were just like the earliest mention of a chocolate phosphate is in a Chicago newspaper article this week, 1893. Way before they were mentioned anywhere else. So it's attributed as being just like Vienna beef hot dogs or deep dish pizza, Italian beef. It is a Chicago invention. And so I would love to hear your story, Bob, because I know you're a fan, right? You're a big fan.
Yeah, I make them. And sometimes I make them with two fingers of milk. And people tell me, no, that's an egg cream. That's no longer a phosphate when you do that. So I don't know.
Some people don't like them. People like the ice cream in their drinks like this, but it is like a total throwback. And I don't know if you can even find one in Chicago other than in my house. Kitchen.
Yeah, that's right. No, never any ice cream, though. Thanks, Anna. We'll talk to you again next Wednesday.